צהריים טובים, good afternoon. האורחים הבאים, welcome, welcome, welcome to Awakening, תורה, מוסר, mindfulness. I am Rabbi Chassi Uriel Steinbauer, founder and director of the Institute for Holiness, Kehilat Musar Mindfulness. Delighted to be here for our weekly dive into the Torah portion of the Parasha. We are entering the book of Leviticus, known as Vayikra in Hebrew. And basically, this whole section is often known as Torat Kohanim, this kind of instruction for the Kohanim, the priest who will be serving and ministering, essentially serving in the tabernacle, in the Mishkan. We had at the end of Shemot, as I had shared with you, the four last Torah portions covered the building of the Mishkan, the building of the centralized community center where our ancestors, the children of Israel, the Hebrews, would be in relationship with the divine, would draw close for intimacy and connection, the place where they would come to seek forgiveness and also express their joys, sharing of sacrifice, of food, learning how to be within a system that they already recognized from the different cultures they came from. So those last four parshiot and shemot in the book of Exodus covered the building of this special mobile sanctuary that essentially, as we said last Torah portion in Pekudei, we said that it was essentially going to be a mobile sanctuary of bringing Har Sinai, that experience of Mount Sinai, where our ancestors were at their closest moment with the divine. So now we enter Vayikra, okay? There are 10 parshiot total for this year. Vayikra actually was celebrated and read out loud in synagogues and minyanim across the world back on the 23rd, I believe, March 23rd. And that was the Hebrew date of Yud Gimel Adar Bet, the second month of Bet. Bet, second month of Adar, in the Hebrew year, Tafshin Pei Dalet, okay? So this is now going to cover what is it that's actually going to happen in this mobile sanctuary of replication of the intimacy and connection of Mount Sinai, of Har Sinai. What's going to be sacrificed there? What's going to be offered? How is it going to go about doing that? So we jump into a system of sacrifice. Now, sacrifice may sound like just the idea of what is called korbanot, which is that you bring either anything from flour, kemach, to birds, to smaller animals, to very large animals, to offer them up on what is known as a mizbeach, an altar, to from a whole range of seeking, from that of celebrating, sharing in a meal, sharing with the priest and family and friends, to coming to seek forgiveness for a sin that was done by mistake, without either really knowing or by omission, and purification offerings also, to move one from a state from what was considered impure to pure. And sacrifice, though, also means something completely different, which we'll dive into after we cover our covenant, our intentions for today's session. Sacrifice means giving up something that is meaningful to you, meaningful to your community, meaningful to your culture, that you are willing to give to God to the maintenance of the priest and the temple. At this time, it was a mobile tabernacle. This idea that in some ways you have to be willing to give up something in order to be in relationship and to draw near. And that idea is often foreign to us today as the modern, often very secular Western cultures, for those of us who are in it. So we'll delve into that and what we can get from this parsha. So before we begin, we always cover our kavanot, our intentions for today's session. I'm going to go ahead and share screen for those of you who are watching on video. Thank you for joining us either live streaming on our YouTube channel. Please subscribe, joining us on the Zoom link, joining us being live streamed on the different mediums and social media, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter. You're also welcome to come. Excuse me, I'm going to sneeze. Excuse me. You're also welcome to go to our website at kehilatmusar.com to go to the blog, where you will find the blog section. You'll find both video and audio of our weekly public offering. So let's go ahead and share screen here. For some reason, I'm not finding it available. Here we go. One of those days. So today you're joining us on Monday, April 1st, 2024. Here in the Haaretz in Israel, it is now 12:53 p.m. So whether you're joining us very early on the east and west coasts of Canada down through South America, or joining us the next day over in New Zealand and Australia, delighted to be here with you. So here we go, our three kavanot. For those of you listening on audio or podcasts, I'm going to just move through these, which we do every day, that we want to merit fulfilling these. And what is the goal? Not that there's the goal, but our great intention is that we're doing this as an act of radical self-care, of connecting with others, doing on behalf of others, and connecting with the divine, however you define the divine or that relationship. So we say this is something that we're doing right now. We're delving into a practice of Musar mindfulness to strengthen our own souls in order to be a benefit to others in the future. We're also doing it to strengthen our relationship to others, so that we can bring God's good to others when they need us. And we're also doing it to strengthen our relationship to God, right? The holy, holy source of all. And we do this because we want to be this vessel, this conduit of God's good to the universe, to the world, to all sentient beings. So may we merit this today by engaging in the learning that is handed down to us from our ancestors and God, in order to really get the most that we can out of this path and practice on behalf of others and our own growth, right? It's all integral. If we're not practicing that radical self-care, we're no good to anyone, really. So it's very important. So what happens here? Here comes our summary. So welcome to Sefer Vayikra, Leviticus. And as I said, the Mishkan, the sanctuary for not only for God and drawing this intimacy and connection, but it's this beautiful place of gathering for the whole community. So the Mishkan was built at the end of Sefer Shemot of Exodus. And as I said, now we're going to learn all about the Korbanot. Now, the Shorish, the root of Korbanot, sacrifices, Kuf Resh Bet, Likrov, is to draw near. It's a closeness. So essentially, by you bringing a korban, you are drawing near to the source of all life. And for those For those who are completely foreign to the concept of animal sacrifice or even offering flour or other mediums, this can be a hard place. This concept of giving life, right? Taking life of the animal, the source of life being its blood, according to our tradition, that's hard. It's especially hard when people have internalized an idea that we don't draw near by causing harm, suffering. The way I like to think of it, first of all, this is an ancient system that was found in most of the systems and cultures and traditions of the ancient Near East. So we can't judge with our modern eyes on them. We can't project onto them a moral stance as if they were wrong. We may choose not to do that for ourselves today, but we don't need to look with judgment in a way that just distances ourselves more from our ancestors. Instead of trying to draw near with curiosity, with kindness, with compassion, to try to understand. So, listen, if this is a system you can imagine. First of all, I don't think meat was being consumed, eaten. We know this for a fact, the way it is today. The way it is today is mostly factory farming, huge, huge complexes, industrial complexes where animals are living in horrible conditions, and then are often harmed in the process of moving through being slaughtered for consumption. And not only that, but the food that they consume, that they put into them to fatten them up or to get them ready for consumption, majority of the agriculture, for instance, in the United States is being used to feed these animals. It's not even being used to feed humans. So pigs, especially cows, chickens, and that source. So the conditions are quite awful. And it's meant for mass cheap consumption of meat and of animals. That system needs to be looked at and questioned and changed over time. What we're dealing with here is people who brought an animal to draw near to the divine, depending on the source, why they were coming. Say they were coming for that which to celebrate something, right? With family and friends, and also to feed the priest. This might be like their only time that week or whoever, however long that they're consuming flesh, meat. And it's being done in the most humane way as possible. The animal was treated well and fed, most likely out for pasture, living its life and the land of Canaan and then Eretz Israel. And when it's brought, it's slaughtered and prepared for consumption together. It's a very different form of eating animal. For those animals that weren't eaten at all, for instance, like an olah offering, that was a complete burnt offering. It went completely up to the divine source, return to its source. So, in some ways, if I'm going to look at it, and of course, there's so many nuances in Bray, I rather see a system where people are coming to a centralized temple, a centralized location, whether it be the mobile sanctuary, the Mishkan, where they're coming to consume and share and draw near, than the way we have it today, mostly. I don't eat factory farm meat, but most people do, especially in the West and the United States, for instance. That means that people are often eating meat daily, maybe even more than one meal a day. This most likely is not happening. And you have to question, is this needed? Now, for some people, they need to consume animal or iron and other sources, whatever is going on in their particular body. I don't come at this with judgment for people, but I understand that some of our viewers will have this reactivity to this system. This is a hard safer, hard book for many people to go into Vayikra. They sometimes can have very strong reactivity, might not identify with it or understand it. So it's our practice together to enter this text as much as we can with beginner mind. The beginner's mind is just going in, looking with curiosity. What can we learn from this? What do we think the intentions of intimacy and connection were? And then we can explore, as we're exploring this whole year, how can we learn to cope from the genocide of October 7th and the ongoing keeping of the captives and the our people who are kidnapped, and the ongoing war and the ongoing, it's actually war at multiple fronts, the ongoing total rise of anti-Jew, anti-Jewishness, people call anti-Semitism, across the world. So what could Vayikra teach us? So let's finish with our summary. So as I said, a korban is a sacrifice, which is something a person gives or offers up for a larger purpose. So if we analyze modern culture today, we say people make sacrifices all the time, right? You spend an hour helping someone, or you spend hours at work earning income, right? You are sacrificing either your time for them or in order to put a roof over your head and food on the table. When you give tzedakah, charity, you are sacrificing your possessions or money for those in need. Maybe people don't feel that way or think that, but some people, this is a way of framing it and understanding it. Parents make sacrifices all the time for their children in order for them to be healthy, happy, whatever the intention is of the parent. So the Torah, coming from God and our ancestors, teaches us that we must make sacrifice for God as well. We make sacrifices all the time for ourselves, for our closest family members, for community, for the world. So we must make sacrifice for God as well. So we already need to shift into a system and understand it and even think, what are we sacrificing for God today? Just sit with it. We don't need to come up with one, not that there is one answer, but we're going to sit with it. The word korban, as I said, comes from karov, close. So the korbanot help us to come close to God and feel connection with God. So it's very important today, which sometimes gets lost in modern practice of Judaism, of rabbinic Judaism, of that when we are drawing close to God through the systems that are in observant Judaism, and even those who bring in other practices, like for instance, tefillah, three times a day praying, we're attempting to draw close to God there and connect with God. The sacrifice there, I suppose, is time. But we need to start thinking, what can we really be sacrificing here, where I will actually feel that I'm giving up something in order to draw close to God and to be there? So as I mentioned last week, I have a practice of giving tzedakah, money, a small amount every day. This is a normal practice in what's called shacharit, the morning prayers, that in the middle of the prayers, you put in a little bit of money into tzedakah box. And you're doing this as part of training the hand to open, nedivut, generosity. So there's multiple factors going on. So we have to look at that. We should look at any time we try to draw close to God through all the mediums available to us in rabbinic Judaism, and additional ones that people may use. So for instance, there isn't like, no one's obligated in rabbinic Judaism to engage in mindfulness, right? In the sense of mindfulness meditation, which I sit and engage in daily every morning, either before or during or after my prayers, which are obligatory. And that is a drawing near. And so anytime I attempt to come close to God and feel connection with God, there should be an element of sacrifice. So we need to We need to figure that out. And the traditional system is giving tzedakah, whether it's money, possessions, and the sort. So this is something I think is going to be ongoing for our people to consider. Here in Haaretz in Israel, our whole system and way of life for our children, for the majority who serve, is the ultimate sacrifice. It's something that we need to look at and consider, right? There are these amazing rituals that happen here that people outside of Israel don't encounter or experience. I was just thinking about this actually, that for instance, in rabbinic Judaism, there's a whole practice of the child, mostly the male child, but in more shivioni, egalitarian practices of halakhic Judaism. There is a practice, both girls and boys, to give them their first haircut at age 3. And it's never stated exactly why we do it, but most scholars assume and think that this is a weaning ceremony, that the child, most likely by age 3, especially in our modern cultures, will have gone through the weaning process off of the mother's breast. And it's a way of symbolically, in a sense, a recutting of the umbilical cord, further distance from the mother. And as we all know, when we birth children, like every single day is a distancing from that ultimate oneness, connection, and intimacy that we had with the baby within, which we need to think about with our relationship with the divine also, who created us, held us so close, this idea of Gan Eden as the womb. And then every day is just a distancing, which is why we need our spiritual discipline and practice of drawing near and drawing close with intention, with kavanah. So this haircutting that takes place at age 3, I did it for my children, both boy and girl. And actually, my children one breastfed nursed. I don't like a calling nurse nursing because not nursing, whatever. Children breastfeed go to the breast for more than just food. So one of my children was till 2.5, and the other till 4.5. So we know in ancient cultures that children can, and still in some island communities and around the world, they can go on until age 6. I think it was Pele, the famous soccer player, who nursed until age 8. Obviously, that's not the norm again in most modern secular Western culture. But this idea that a haircutting takes place at age 3. Now, what do we have in Eretz Israel for the majority who go and serve in our military, particularly for the boys, but sometimes for the girls becoming young men and becoming women? We say that at B'nai Mitzvah, they become young men and young women, but we all know, I think we all agree that at age 12 or 13, they're not adults or becoming adults. Yes, they do through the system of mitzvot, of commandments. That's a whole other thing. It'd be very interesting if rabbinic Judaism actually shifted its observance to where modern neuroscience, brain science, shows us that someone's actually fully developed the executive brain and really can take on the mitzvot and the commitment and the obligation. Now, of course, you want to train people before they get to that moment because they need the keva, the constant practice and set habituation and practice before they arrive at that moment of adulthood. But today they're, saying age 28, 27, 28, I think the latest research came out. So could you imagine, like in rabbinic Judaism, if we said that the actual B'nai Mitzvah and the whole ceremony of reading Aliyah to the Torah, which in my practice, as like modern orthodoxy that is egalitarian, feminist, both girls and boys. So this would be men and women actually finally having an aliyah to the Torah and joining the covenant fully with their own full consent and covenant intention. That's a whole other thing, where obviously religion and ritual don't necessarily match and fit modern understanding of brain science research and where we are today. So we'll just leave that. But what is the practice here in Israel is at 18, when the child is about to go into miluim, which the word in the Torah, which we just had, is the inauguration of the Kohanim, of the priests who were at the within the Mishkan for those 7 days doing their training, last Torah portion and Pikudei. So our children enter a similar service and training, similar to the Kohanim. It's not a mistake. It's not also a coincidence that these words are used. So there's a real clear understanding throughout our ancestry that everyone serve, everyone fight if needed when there is an enemy, and having that trained army. And so when our children get ready for this process, particularly the males, but there are females who do this also, their friends come. And this time it's the friends. It's not the parents or the father or mother or mothers and fathers. The closest friends, they draw near. They draw near for a sacrifice. And the 8-year-old is about to enter that army service, is about to sacrifice something. Very important to them to enter that service of state, of military, of God, towards God, essentially. And that is, they cut their hair. And this time they cut the whole thing. They don't become bald, but it's very short. You can imagine that military crew cut. Not even a crew cut. It's just completely to the head. So for instance, my next door neighbor, Ivri, may Hashem protect him with all the soldiers, is entering the military right now. And they just had a wonderful ceremony where the friends came and gave him a haircut. So this is a drawing near to God, a feeling connection to God, to Am, to the nation, the people. All right, the final conclusion is korbanot in the Torah are usually animal sacrifices, although they can also be made from spices, from grains, oil, and wine. So korbanot were offered, as I said, in the Mishkan and later on in history in the Beit Hamikdash and the Holy Temple every single day. Every single day. There were also special korbanot sacrifices for Shabbat and holidays. So that is our summary. And now I'm going to move in what we need. I feel like we need to get from this Torah portion. And then we're going to move into our practice of mindfulness meditation together. So for those of you following, I'm sure you've already studied this and moved in on this. We are in Leviticus chapter 1, Pasuk Aleph, number 1, through chapter 5, Pasuk verse 26. As you saw in reading through this, there are principal types of sacrifices, several classes. The key thing that's so beautiful, I think is beautiful, is that there are different levels of sacrifice, and they're all equal in the eyes of God and the law. Now, are they equal in actual how the people feel about them in practice? The Torah is not concerned with that. The Torah is concerned with offering that the wealthiest people can bring that huge hefer, a huge cow, and the people who are of poor means can obviously bring flour or any of the other lower, or for instance, a bird. So these are all presented to God in the sanctuary. They're offered regularly. Some are offered with limited application. The key thing that's very important to understand here is a lot of people think, I think this comes from Christianity and modern Western culture, this idea that If you sinned, you just brought a sacrifice and it was over, like you were cleansed in some way. The only time you were allowed to bring an offering for a sin in our ancestors' system was through a sin of omission or inadvertent violation, meaning you didn't mean it. You didn't mean it. You forgot. It was something not done with kavanah and intention. Like, I'm going to sin. I'm purposely doing this to move away from God, right? To rebel, or however, why people sin, okay? On purpose. So the only time a korban was allowed for sin was, as I said, was omission, that you just forgot something, okay? And like the classic example is that you had committed to bring like an olah offering. You said, you even said it to the Kohen, I'm going to bring an olah offering on Thursday, you know, April 4th or whatever the date is. And you forget, which we all forget. We forget to do our intended deeds daily. And so the Kohen says that you forgot to come on October 4th. So now you need to do actually a sin offering. It's no longer going to be the Olah. All right. It's moved into Bishgaga, and this is a kind of mistaken sin. This allows people to restore relationship, not only restore the relationships to the divine, but also to be a fit member of the kehillah, the community. Nobody wants people walking around sinning and not taking responsibility for it. It breaks the very foundation and fabric of the society. So there is no ritual remedy. There is no korban or sacrifice for intentional or premeditated sins or offenses. This is very important to know. Okay? You can't get rid of that sin or purify yourself through sacrifice. That's not the means. Okay? It has to happen through the system of law and order. This is why we need a system of law. That's one of the key reasons. So, what happens in law is real consequences and punishments are given in the court of law, and also they're given to act to prevent reoccurrence. Okay, so there is something that does get equated, and let me see if I can share this with you. It happens in Western culture too, which I think we inherit from the Torah, which is, and also just the cultures that we inherited around that. There is a connection, even in people's minds and hearts today, between sinfulness and impurity. So many technical terms can be used for both sin and impurity. And at the time of inequity, there has been a tendency in many cultures and languages to juxtapose ritual and legal concepts. So if you think you have the legal category of someone is guilty or innocent, which then carries a moral weight to it, and then you have the ritual side of someone's in a state of either impurity or purity. And these begin to conflate. They end up coming together. So even today, we use the word fault, like you're at fault, right? To connote both a physical or structural and imperfection, as well as a misdeed. So in the context of ritual, one is perceived as pure or impure, which implies a physical or nearly physical state, could be also an inner state, depending on the impurity. In the context of law, one is innocent or guilty, which relates primarily to deed, to behavior. So in the Levitical codes, in Leviticus, in Vayikra, in the Torah, as in many ancient traditions, these two contexts have been blended. Okay, so that which is sinful at the time is also impure. Why? Why? You cannot approach the sanctuary in God in a state of impurity. Impurity that's someone's premeditated and is doing so with intention, because there's something odd here that you do have to come with your sinful state, your sin, and your impurity in that case in order to purify. So you're allowed to draw near when I said there's omission or inadvertent violation. But anyone who is on this kind of habitual or premeditated cycle of sin, of distancing themselves both from people and God and sanctuary, are in a state of impurity. They're not allowed to approach. So conversely, the forgiven person is purified. They go through a mechanism, right? So consequently, the chatat sacrifice, the sin offering, can be viewed both as a form of purification and as a removal of one's guilt for the sin that was not done intentionally, was not premeditated, okay? There is also a cause and effect relationship to be considered. Sinful acts are often, if not always, the very ones that cause impurity. So we have this today. I often hear even practitioners will say, you know, if they've done something that goes completely against their values, say they just treated their spouse very poorly. They got in a big fight and they acted out. They screamed, they said words that were harmful, not in alignment with their Torah, Dharma values. And they really, they have sinned and they feel impure. It's like a state of not being in alignment, feeling like, how am I going to correct this, both with this person that I have hurt? Anyone else who was witness or heard it was also received harm and suffering in addition to the person who spoke. How are they going to correct themselves with God? And this is something that we understand very deeply and how we live. And what's amazing about our ancestors is they understood that there needed to be a system that they're drawing near and trying to have connection with the divine was also to correct their relationships with others, done at the same time, and to move through a state of purity and to not be in a habitual cycle of sin, especially if it was premeditated. Now, there's something very important here. There is a presumption among our ancestors, right, is that in the Israelites, the Hebrew possessed full awareness and knowledge, if they were fully full awareness of their community, what was expected of them, of the laws, they would seek to obey God's laws, not violate them. That is the operating presumption. So much so that even today we have this concept of dan lekaf zechut, giving someone the benefit of the doubt. We walk around as Jews, and I think some of this has been inherited a little bit in Western culture. We walk around saying, okay, any Jew, and often extended to even our allies, non-Jews, that someone possesses full awareness of God, of what is expected of them, right, to seek to obey God's laws, that they will seek to do so and not violate them, always giving people the benefit of the doubt. Now, obviously we are a clash of civilizations, and we have whole organizations, if not states, modern nation states, that are completely operating in a different cultural milieu. Where their understanding of God and what is expected of them is completely at odds with our understanding of it. And so when they go ahead and violate our norms and values, for instance, let's look at the genocide of October 7th, of entering a foreign country, our own, and committing the worst atrocities and crimes against humanity. And that is being interpreted in their culture as a resistance or justified, or what would be commanded by their prophet or their understanding of God, because we're not them. That you're beginning to, and I'm sure our ancestors ran into this with the non-Israelites around them, a complete clash of civilizations, of looking at people. I mean, you could imagine if you came across a culture of ch child sacrifice, where people are offering up their children. We would have issues with that. And this is where we are right now, right? If we look around the world, there are sets of people that we can give the benefit of the doubt to and say they wouldn't really be behaving this way. Either they don't have full awareness or knowledge, because they would be seeking to follow the law and God's laws, right? I think this is a huge exploration that's going to go on, obviously, for quite some time. The final thing I will say that I think is important to all of us is that in Vayikra chapter 1, verse 1, okay, it says, Vayikra el Moshe, Vayedaber Hashem el Elav, Me'ohel Moed Lemor. So God calls out, right? Vayikra. God calls out to Moshe. And then Vayedaber Hashem Elav, God spoke to him. Spoke to Moshe from the tent of meeting, another way of saying Mishkan. So, of course, our ancestors and our brilliant commentators and sages throughout time are like, why these two verbs? Why this seems redundant, repetitive. Why do you have to call out and speak? And so, there's something quite beautiful that gets interpreted here. That Rashi from our great Parshan, a commentator from France 1,000 years ago, says that even before speaking or saying or commanding, there was a calling out. There was a calling, and that this calling is an expression of love. And of course, he's going to bring a source to prove this and show this. A language of love that the angels use, as it is said, the angels, vakara, same shoresh, kuf resh alesh, vakara ze el ze. This comes from Yeshayahu chapter 6, verse 3. The angels would call to each other. So we're imagining that God is calling to Moshe. And through Moshe and even onward, God is calling to us. Come. I love you. I'm in love with you. I want to be in relationship with you. I want you to seek me and that intimacy and connection. And then we talk, right? That is our practice and has been and should have always been, especially since October 7th. We call to each other. I'm in love with you. I'm here. I see you. I see me. Let's sit and support one another. Let's sit and speak. Let's sit and gather. How can we sacrifice? How can we draw near to God? How can we cope? How can we heal? How can I bring God's good to you? How can I be a conduit? How can I be there for you when you need me? This is our daily practice. We should be waking up each day. How can I help my people, those in need? So many people are in pain here, who are recovering, who have post-traumatic stress disorder, who are in massive amount of rehabilitation and therapy, hundreds and thousands with limbs that have been sacrificed, have been removed through warfare or the violence, the crimes against humanity on October 7th. And people, allies, and people come. They volunteer. They work on the farms. They are coming in any way or form to Vayikra, right? I'm calling. They're calling. They're seeking in love, and they're offering. And that is our practice. That is our path of Musar mindfulness. May we merit it. We're going to move into our meditation now. So please assume one of the past four postures of mindfulness meditation. You can lie down if needed. Keep your eyes open if you have vision, so you remain awake and alert. You're welcome to walk back and forth of walking meditation. Now, the walking isn't actually walking to somewhere. It's just in the process of being walking. You can stand. I recommend like standing next to a chair because sometimes people get a little weak in their standing, maybe a strong mountain pose. Or you can be like me, seated in a chair or on a zafu, on a meditation cushion. I come to the edge of the chair. For those of you who are, have a practice, you know what to do. For beginners, please come to an upright, dignified position. You are created in the image and likeness of the divine. That's how you should sit and feel. Bring in oxygen as a gift from the divine. This is God's calling us all the time, giving this oxygen. Inhalation. Exhale, letting go of any dis-ease. Inhalation, the gift from the divine. Exhaling, stillness and calmness are arriving. This time, raising your shoulders up and let them go. Exhalation. Closing your eyes if you feel safe and comfortable, otherwise, lowering your gaze, allowing your hands to settle wherever they're comfortable. It can be on your lap. Maybe you're holding your heart or your stomach, whatever works for you in this moment. Real invitation to yourself, like a best friend, to fully arrive, body, head, heart, thoughts, mind, states, moods, all our guests. Welcoming the guests into our home. And the practice is just to observe. Letting the breath fall to its own natural rhythm, no need to control it. This is not an exercise in breathing meditation. And we just watch with curiosity, with what's called a beginner's mind. Whatever arises, maybe we have a real quiet state in body and in thoughts. For some of us, it might be more what we call monkey mind. Many, many thoughts jumping all around to the future, planning, ruminating about something in the past, just noticing, no need to push them away, no need to control them. No need to identify with them and make them into a movie, into a story, or into a narrative. Just being. Knowing that this too shall pass. Everything passes with time. Everything changes. So sometimes I think the greatest sacrifice, especially for our own radical self-care, is a deep, deep practice of aharayut, of responsibility and self-restraint. And what do I mean by this? Our worlds are so filled up with objects, with activities to do, with images to look at, with posts to read and respond to, with relationships, with having to put food on the table, with having to work, whatever it is, it's full, very full life. And in that fullness, we need to learn to withdraw. Withdraw temporarily for practice and well-being. Doing so responsibly with wise intention, with appropriate withdrawal, appropriate space, to know to say the sacrifice today is I'm not going to spend that 15 minutes, that half hour, that hour or hours on screen time. I'm going to spend this 45 minutes to an hour learning Torah and engage in mindfulness meditation with Rabbi Chassia. Every choice has consequences. This is the law of cause and effect. And every choice has a sacrifice. It has either something that's going to be life-affirming or not. So by you sacrificing that habituated desire that clicks into the part of the hormone in brain that gains temporary pleasure by hitting the click button or the reply button or the scrolling of the thumb, or even allowing the eyes to watch a screen, that's a moment of sacrificing that in order to draw close and near to the ultimate source, also for your own well-being. And that sometimes is the most difficult for practitioners, for all of us to do today, is learning to say no to all the options that are in front of us all the time. Some of us more than others, depending on privilege and location. How overwhelming. How do I learn the skill of discipline? Learning what to say yes to and no to. This we do in community, in Avad, where we practice the path of Musar mindfulness together. We learn to strengthen our spiritual muscles, to know what is called upon us, Hashem, God, constantly calling us, Vayikra, right? I'm calling you, I love you, I see you, to come to serve. And that requires sacrifice. It requires learning to be okay with FOMO, with fear of missing out. We're always going to miss out on something. The question is, one, are you really missing out? But maybe you are. But the choice to engage in this path and practice and other acts that are wise and kind and appropriate, those have such an important effect, not only on our own lives, but on all those around us. So even if it's just a pause, so much of this practice is learning to pause, creating a space between the match and the fuse, which really means between whatever stimuli or possibility is before us and our own response or reactivity. So every moment really is a choice. Am I going to stay on this path towards holiness? Or am I going to allow myself to become distracted? Right? Knowing that everything really comes down to being of benefit to the whole, community, to the whole world, to sentient beings. And that requires sacrifice. That requires answering God's call to be in love, to love as a verb, which means service, which means doing for others and often doing for ourselves, so that we can be this conduit of God's good, so we can be this vessel. So one small practice, simple thing, is before any act, even if you can catch one a day, say to yourself, is this what I need to be doing right now? Is this life affirming? Is this an expression of my values? Is this answering God's call of love to be in connection and intimacy and relationship? So it can be as simple as when you automatically pick up that smartphone if you have one. First, even before you pick it up, but say you've already picked it up and you start moving that thumb to scroll or open, pause. Is this what I need to be doing right now? Is this really going to connect me with God and others? Surely there's someone around you who would like to talk with you, would like to receive a hug, maybe break bread with you. Surely there are so many other things that we could be doing on behalf of this service and this path. Checking in with how you're feeling right now. What is your state and your mood? Any reactivity to my words? Just note it, whatever arises. Allowing for a minute of silent meditation before I ring the bell to pull us out. If you had your eyes closed, allow them to gently and slowly open, allowing the light to slowly filter in, especially if you're watching the video before you join us on this sacred Zoom screen, live streaming. Giving a great bow to Hashem, to God, the Divine, for bringing us together for this moment, allowing me to be that conduit of God's good, to bring these teachings from our ancestors and from God. So bowing to our ancestors, to each other, giving yourself a great bow for you committing to your practice, really taking refuge in the community of the Institute for Holiness, Kehilat Musar Mindfulness. Again, I'm Rabbi Chas Uriel Steinbauer, delighted to be here with you. We are going to cover just this last Shabbat's Torah portion, which is Tzav. It will be called Caught Up. Thank you for your patience and understanding. So for those of you who are following along, you'll want to, if you haven't read already from last Shabbat, which happens on March 30th. Yes, that was Kaf, right? Kaf of Adar Bet. In Parshat Tzav, it's chapter 6, it starts verse 1 and goes at least through chapter 7, actually through 8, 8 through, I think it's 8 through 36. Yes. Just double checking that. Yes. So it's chapter 6, verse 1 through chapter 8, verse 36. We're going to be looking at the disposition of sacrifices, the korbanot. So do reach out to us. We are delighted to accept your financial support, donations, tzedakah. We also take sponsorship in honor or memory of anyone for these weekly offerings and to support the Institute's work. We are thriving here despite the terrorism and the war and the keeping of our people kidnapped and as captives and onward with several Musar Vadim groups, Musar mindfulness practice. And it's a delight. Coming up on April 14th, I have been invited to engage in a short discussion of Musar mindfulness. In particular, Musar is part of this under the umbrella of the Jewish spiritual discipline world. And I'll be in conversation with the director, the CEO of the Institute for Jewish Spirituality based in the United States. And that will be, excuse me, at 6:30 p.m. on the 14th, UK time, United Kingdom time. So I think that's 8:30 p.m. here. You're all welcome to register. Just go look for from the Institute called Macomb, or just type in Google Jewish or a symposium for Jewish meditation, and you'll be able to register there. We'd be delighted to have you. excuse me. And I think that's it for today. And soon Sav will come this week, Bezrat Hashem. Take care. Thank you again for today.